So it's my pleasure to chair today's panel. My name is Ralf Ubel. I will briefly introduce my co-panelists. Rachel has already been introduced.
Yes, so. I forgot my notes. Hang on. Keep going. Yeah.
Antonio Sommaini is a professor at Paris Trois, Sorbonne Nouvelle. He has written extensively on film and media studies, a book on Sergei Eisenstein. He published in, I think, two or three languages. It's out. And then he has co-edited with Andrea Pinotti just recently a book on visual culture in Italian, also an anthology on aura e shock in Italian. So it's an anthology of Benjamin's writings, and also another anthology on Teoria dell'immagine. So I don't have to explain any further why he's part of this panel. And just recently in Grey Room this winter, a long article about the notion of medium and apparatus in Benjamin has been published. Beate Fricke on my left is a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. She is expert in medieval art, has published her first book, which has been translated into English, has the title Fallen Idols or Risen Saints on the Sainte-Foy in Conques, so one of the major, very early examples of Christian image making is a full sculpture statue. And this reminds us that today we speak about pictures, but we also want to think about images, so three-dimensional images. And she has further finished a manuscript, which is under review on beautiful Genesis, creation and procreation in late medieval art. And from this context, it is clear that she is very interested in one notion that has been very prominent in recent picture theory, the notion of animation and liveliness, but she has also published on other concepts pertinent to us, like mimesis or the relationship of interpretation and materiality in allegory. And in her most recent work, at least that's what she has written to me, she's particularly interested in the temporal structure of images. My name is Ralf Ubel. I'm an art historian as well, and I am here probably because I have written together with my friend and colleague Wolfram Pichler a short book, Bildtheorie zur Einführung, Picture Theory or Image Theory, an Introduction. And obviously, this would be now very tempting to give you a summary of this book, but this maybe we have only 90 minutes, so I want to start with a very short remark on the notorious term Bildwissenschaft, a term with which probably most German art historians have huge difficulties to identify with, but on the other hand is something like an enigmatic signifier in Anglo-Saxon discourse on pictures. And fortunately, from reading Rachel's introduction to picturing, I have now I got a meaning of Bildwissenschaft I can identify with. And it's that Bildwissenschaft, so to speak, is the answer emerged out from art history, so to speak. Art history's genuine, proper answer to the challenge how to think about pictures, images, as soon as we don't want first to narrow our corpus to art, and second, if what kind of potential is in the kind of classical corpus of art historical writings, Frigel, Wölflin, Warburg, what kind of potential is in this writing to confront the challenges also posed by visual culture and other attempts to widen the corpus of our objects. And if we think about Bildwissenschaft in this term, or use it as a label for art history's proper genuine response to the image question, then it's certainly not a German project or a project from German from writers in German tongue, but there are major contributions in U.S. American, English, Scottish, French, Italian art history. And since we're here at the Terra Foundation, I only want to mention three authors from the U.S. American academia, which have been particularly important to my own work. First, Jim Elkins. Second, already mentioned today and discussed, David Summers, his great book Real Space. And last but not least, Whitney Davis, who just recently published A General Theory of Visual Culture. And I've mentioned these three authors because in one respect, they also stand out from the field of Bildwissenschaft, because they are all very interested in, let's say, work out and do a lot of genuinely conceptual work and don't shy away from confronting a kind of systematic approach to the image question. And in general, one could say, or at least I have written this in the abstract of our discussion today, that most contributions to image studies, picture theory from art history, are case studies or are studies of specific historical concepts of picture, tableau, painting, image, whatsoever. And generally speaking, I think one could say that art historians are a little bit uncomfortable with the kind of systematic ambitions. Very few art historians, like to confront. And I think there are also very good reasons to be uncomfortable with it, because from art history we know that in the very first place, the corpus of objects we consider as images or pictures is historically highly contingent. So we feel reassured that we should, so to speak, remain in our own discipline of historical inquiry and historical investigation of specific historically contextualized concepts of images and pictures. So I have a lot of sympathy with art history's reluctance to engage this broader systematic project, and I understand, that's at least the way I understood Rachel's introduction and to today's conference, but also to the book, that the book Picturing is also an example of how to historicize concepts of the concept of picture and of picturing. But at the same time, at least that's the way I have read the book, this historization or this kind of genealogy of the concept of picture is also linked to the hope that from a historical genealogy we can learn something about how to use these pictures these notions in our own research, how to use them as analytic tools. So, to speak, that's maybe something most art historians would agree on, that a genealogy of theoretical concepts is a kind of historical inquiry, but at the same time there's a certain, let's say, theoretical promise or hope attached to it. And in preparing for our conversation today, I thought that in the work I've read of yours, this ambition to do a kind of genealogy of certain concepts and to put them to work again is some kind of common ground we share. And I thought that the way we should proceed is that each of us gives a short introduction, focusing on one notion, on one concept that is particularly important, productive to one's own research, in this twofold perspective of historical genealogy and also creating some kind of analytical tool. And Rachel, you, because the book you have published is also the occasion of our gathering today, I think I would like to ask you first to go deeper in the in your introduction. You announced that you would like to go to speak more about the concept of operation and operationality. Mm-hmm. And so maybe let's start with this. How is this link picturing and operationality or operation?
Sure. I actually, if we could pull up my picture, I'll start by saying that I mean, in a way, my entire presentation could boil down to saying yes to what you just said about the relationship between case study and the historical genealogy produced by that case study as generating analytical tools, as generating theory. And I want, in a way, to do this and by talking about this picture, which will get me to that question about operation. Because operation for me is an absolutely fundamental term, and I'll explain why as I go. So what I think I'll do to get to that question about operation is conduct a kind of demonstration with this picture of what I mean when I say that operation is fundamental to my thinking. So for those of you who don't know what this is Darwin's diagram from On the Origin of Species, and it was the only diagram, or picture I should say, included in the publication in 1859, which may or may not come as a surprise to you, but it should, because it was highly unusual for a book of that sort in the 1850s to have only one picture. And it appears in chapter 4 on natural selection, and that is exactly what it shows. It shows natural selection. And so what you're seeing on the bottom are a series of capital letters, A through L, represent the species of a large genus native to a particular region. And then there are what Darwin himself, in the narrative that explains this diagram, there are, and if we could turn the lights down a little bit, it would actually be better, we'd be better able to see this. These little dotted lines, Darwin described as little fans of diverging dotted lines, those represent, the cursor's not showing up, those represent the offspring of each of those species. So A gives birth to those little fans of dotted lines, so to speak. And the horizontal lines, demarcated with lowercase letters, indicate the appearance of a new variety. And the spaces between the lines are equal to 1,000 generations. So there are about 14,000 generations represented here. So it's a picture of deep time, of infinitesimal changes over deep time. It's not an empirical tree. It's not based on data gathered through observation. That won't happen until later. This is, in a sense, a purely theoretical image. And we know what it means. It means evolution, right? Its content is species diverge. My interest in it, and why I'm talking about it now, is manifold. It's not art. It's only questionably or marginally a picture. It's interesting because it was the only picture in the book, and that means one of the first questions one must ask is why this picture, and why a picture at all? Because the text by which Darwin explains this picture pretty much says it all. So you can read the text without the picture and understand fully what he's saying. You can also read the 350 pages of On the Origin of Species and fully understand what he's saying without this picture. Putting those questions aside, this picture, I think, serves as a really wonderful, at least in my opinion, let's just say productive, wonderful might be overreaching, a productive object lesson or demonstration in what Ralph in his charge to us and in the abstract called the a defamiliarizing of picturing. And I think rethinking picturing for us has to involve this kind of defamiliarization. And so I want to say a little bit about picturing, and I promise I'm getting to your question about operation. Picturing, the book isn't called Pictures or The Picture or Picture Theory because I didn't want to invoke a noun. I wanted a verb, which is why operation is relevant here, because operations tend to be verbs rather than nouns. And it's a transitive verb, which means it's an action that has a direct object, but it's also, and here's your little lesson in grammar here, it's also a present participle of to picture, right? So present participles run along the lines of I am thinking, I am picturing now. And this means that there's a fourfold effect embedded or incarnated in the term picturing. It implies action. It refers to something other than itself. It embodies temporality. And this is key, it implies a subject amidst other subjects, objects, entities, and phenomena. And what I just said, and I'm getting at the question that Ralph asked us over email, what is theory in your work? How does it relate to the historical conditions described by the material about which you're writing? But also, and this is in part related to something that Jim Elkin said last night, and I know all of you weren't here last night, but he said that theory is a thing that we use, or is that, what was your phrase, Jim?
I have no idea.
theory is something we forget. It's
yeah. Well, anyway, so what I've just said, picturing implies action, it refers to something other than itself, it embodies temporality, and it implies a subject admits other subjects, phenomenon, entities, object. All of what I just said is manifestly informed by a whole slew of theoretical paradigms. I couldn't have come to the term picturing as an organizing term, concept, or paradigm unless I was familiar with phenomenology and affect theory, of course, Bild Wissenschaft, network theory, this includes Latour, among others, anthropology, especially writing about the life and the agency of objects, material culture studies, materiality studies. Coming to the term picturing was made possible by my encounters with this writing. But to answer the question that Ralph posed, what do I as an art historian expect from theory? Is I don't take theory as fact, and I don't take theory to be explanatory. For me, it doesn't help me figure out what something means. Rather, it shapes how I look at that thing. So it shapes what I look for. And above all, what it does is compels description on my part. That is to say, observation and description. A thick description of a thing like that. And so theorizations of how things in the world work, right? That's what theory is. Have reshaped my sense of what an artifact is and does. But this only happens for me with an encounter with the object. And with the activation through encounter with what I call that object's theorization of itself. Okay? And here is where case study generates historical genealogy, which then generates analytical tool, okay? Because I don't see the thing and theory as mutually exclusive. My job as an art historian is, in a sense, the job of a switch flipper. I flip the switch of the object, which then, in the encounter between me and my ideas and the manner in which it talks back to me, and I'm not personifying pictures here. Pictures are not people, too. I understand that. What happens is a certain kind of mutation or disfiguration of the ideas I bring to bear on a picture like this one, and thus a defamiliarization. So what I do with a picture like this is try to figure out how a certain paradigm of understanding it can be generated by looking closely and thickly at it. And so there's a way in which I'm combining a kind of structuralist approach, this is how images work, with an utterly and even myopically historical approach, this is how this picture works. Now, to the question of operation. What thinking about this not as a picture or an image, but as an activity or an act of picturing allows me to understand this in a fully expanded field. And rather than this being a thing that exists in two dimensions, or what Deleuze and Guattari would, or I should say it's what Deleuze and Guattari describe as, and Virla talks wonderfully about this in the essay in the Perspectives Journal, what they describe as a moment of crystallization and a much longer process. I see picturing as a concept as making clear to us that our objects of study aren't objects but situations and constellations of operations. They're systems and networks, not representations, real metaphors. They're not simply signs that are mimetic or not. They are situations or maybe even terrains. And here's where operations come into the mix. Because if you think about this picture in this expanded field as a situation or as a terrain, what you wind up having to bear in mind isn't just that this means evolution, but that it is the result of travel and field work, of reading, of collecting, of pigeon breeding, of examining thousands of bird skins collected in London. It's a matter of printmaking, of making the decision to use lithography instead of engraving, which is a totally bizarre decision, because why would you use such a fluid and spontaneous medium like lithography to make a diagram, which employs dots and dashes and incredibly precise marks? You think about typology, you think about the process by which Darwin made this. He mocked it up by cutting and pasting letters to templates and then recutting and repasting letters and deciding capital or lowercase, Roman or Arabic. And so what you have in picturing, not in a picture, is a cluster of operations and activities, which for me, at least for my own work, wound up being kind of revelatory, because it revealed to me, let me see if I can say this properly. This wound up for me being, maybe revelatory isn't the right word, but it opened up pictures to something far more than a conception of them as products of a linear trajectory. And so for me, it means that I can understand them as existing in a field of operations and also as operating within that field. And this has allowed me to point to ways in which the questions and ideas I bring to images can only tell me so much. Because if you're thinking about a terrain or a situation or a constellation or a system, you have a layering of different meanings and different ideas, some of which will always remain completely obscure, to which we will always be blind. And that means that part of understanding what picturing is involves accepting a certain kind of failure to understand what picturing is, which in a way is what is embodied by Darwin's diagram, because it totally fails to tell us really anything, except that Darwin wanted a diagram in his book for whatever reason. Because what it had led me to understand is that in bringing ideas to a picture like this one, the picture can resist and tell me, and again, I'm not being animistic here, I'm speaking metaphorically, and the thing can say to me, no, this is what I am. No, this is how I understand myself. Or I'm not telling. And thinking operationally made me realize that in every case, it is fundamentally impossible to do a certain kind of art history, which is a full decoding of meaning. Does that answer your question about operation? I'm done.
I think I would a couple of further questions, but before I ask them, Beate, now it's your turn. What is your answer to the charges I put on you?
Yeah, my answer is twofold, like every other part of what comes is now somehow twofold. Mm-hmm. So the first is a comment that reacts a little bit on what has been said yesterday in the first part and gives a historiographic view of how I see what is going on in the field. And the second part is my answer to your question. And I've spelled it out, then it goes quicker. Rethinking pictures could bridge, or as you suggested today, passage two different realms or two different trajectories. The two different realms could be divided into approaches thinking systematically about the nature and elements of pictures, what they are, how they are composed, which elements they include, or to put it in a nutshell, thinking within the picture. While the other realm would include context broadly spoken, the realm beyond the actual picture, that is, historical context and changes, different practices of perception and reception, varying cultural traditions and their image cultures. The five different traditions of or schools of visual studies James Elkins has described yesterday sometimes address both, for example, like the Tiflis school, or what you describe as Bildwissenschaften, which I somehow also have similar reaction to that. Then, oh, I could never identify with that, but in your description, I somehow can.
Maybe it's naivete.
Sometimes they stay within one of those two areas. Some subfields of the five different visual studies, like built anthropology or build theory, are primarily at home in one of those two realms, but include moments of the other. Describing those art historical practices as schools or traditions, or sorting them into larger historiographic traditions, as my colleague Whitney Davis has done it recently, is very helpful to understand their backgrounds and implications, but also implies a retrospective and or a manifesto moment. Both those attitudes are interestingly those latter ones are interestingly primarily articulated by male voices in our field. Exceptions like Michael and Holly or Rachel confirm the rule, which is, of course, no rule. Beyond those explicitly articulated theories or approaches from within our field, we, as Elkins has already pointed out yesterday, we primarily read theories developed in another field, literature, philosophy, anthropology, or media studies. And names would be Derrida, Goodman, Rossier, Luhmann, Feierabend, Rheinberger, Lacan, Kittler, Gerlatou, Bennett, to just name a few which have been on our minds in the past decade. Studies from our own field who focus on one topic within a subfield, but whose results have or would have implications for the entire discipline, are harder to place within these panorama. I'm thinking of Arras, Alpers, Baxendorf, Bredekamp, Belting, Cummins, Flood, Gamboni, Marin, Mierzov, Monsen, or Samos. Again, just to name a few, and that is really just showing my ignorance to some studies I have now not mentioned. And So it just represents my ignorance against several important contributions in subfields I'm not reading as systematically as I could or should. The easiness to get funding or interdisciplinary research and the difficulty to find money to exchange on theoretical level among our regionally or chronologically divided subfields supports this lack of exchange and weakens the general discussion of theoretical approaches across the discipline. And I think this is one of the few exceptions we actually have, this exchange, especially also between theory and kind of discussions about one specific topic where we really start from one object and then ask the theory question. But beyond these practical and disciplinary problems, I would like to point out another issue, now comes the answer to your question, which affects my own work in particular. Think along two trajectories, theoretically what pictures are and do, and historically how those aspects change is particularly interesting and revealing. I would like to give you an example that may reveal what is at stake in doing this. Dealing with pre-modern images and visual cultures, the two terms which connect several of the theoretical approaches that are relevant for my own work are evidentia and speculatio. Evidentia, which we would translate today with evidence, and speculatio, which we would today translate with speculation, have experienced significant transformation, and they really mean today the opposite of what they meant at that time, and that is what I find particularly interesting. And are of particular relevance for our discussion of rethinking pictures. Today, evidence and speculation are words with several meanings. Mirroring circumscribes the, I quote, reflection of a reality that presents itself as an empirical fact, end of quote. At the same time, as Boas Quarz has pointed out, it can mean a reflection on reality that may be hidden behind its empirical image. These words describe well the situation medievalists encounter on a daily basis. We reflect on ideas we have about realities that lay hidden, covered by their appearance today. For Quarz, speculation is then, I quote him again, a reflection on the mirror and not merely the reflection in the mirror, end of quote. So each of our studies as medievalists or early modern scholars could be a reflection on this speculum. Speculatio, this is the term Boethius, so the late antique early medieval philosopher, uses to translate the Greek term theoria. This comes a bit as a surprise since most readers at that time and also medievalists would have expected contemplatio. The noun, built from the intransitive verb specular, observing, watching, seeing, witnessing, embeds a constellation, an observer, and a situation, and at the same time expresses the ambivalence or even insecurity of what the seer makes of the visible evidence. Speculation and evidence are both terms that since then have experienced a history of insightful changes in their meaning. Today, they almost point to the contrary of their original meaning. Speculatio, or what was once the subject of contemplation and insight in the early Middle Ages, was ambivalent, provided insights which were in the end a matter of interpretation. The visible object, situation, matter, was not taken as evident. In the modern period, speculation has gained a negative notion to act or bet on something which is uncertain, unclear, and subject of change. As a scholar working on pre-modern image cultures and medieval theories of seeing, I often have to reveal several layers of time to uncover what we then conclude as has been maybe an original setting, appearance of an object or intention. Each of these layers, changing or fragmenting an original content or context, may have added a change of notion, a rupture of the original condition or plan. So there are several layers in between which I have to consider when I work on something that is so far past. These two movements I am describing here, the historical change of the notions of the word speculatio and the unfolding of historical layers of time are opposing each other. So I have to work against back with my own kind of forms, but at the same time I know that there have been a lot of changes, and that's exactly where my work usually is situated and where I get kind of into trouble. So unfolding the historical layers of time are opposing each other and sometimes like enemies, although they are of course bedfellows. Augustine, who has a slightly easier take on speculatio, he just says, longi videre hoc est speculatio, looking, regarding, or observing for a long time. This is speculatio. He describes it like crossing a sea with open eyes, not navigando, so not sailing, not calculating, but seeing, and by doing so, producing evidencia. So rethinking pictures for me is foremost and primarily an enterprise to understand the various layers of time that obscure the past and block our access to understand, see, and interpret the layers within a picture and before it. So I usually work with both of the issues I described before, the related visual culture. So most of my work could be described as an exploration of this double movement, what it means to reveal what time has carried and what makes us to rethink pictures of the past and learn from our modern insights into objects what it meant to speculate in the past. So two double movements that connect present and past. What is perhaps the most foundational difference is the plurality of different visual regimes within the same picture and the same visual culture. Most images I'm dealing with do not subscribe to one coherent concept of image. That's also something foundational difference for and often irritating for scholars who don't work with pre-modern images. So often they have really different pictorial realities in one image. But they reveal multiple, so my images and or objects reveal multiple different systems of representation and imply a variety of forms how images and ideas relate to concrete pictures or ideas in my mind. And so I'm usually using the word image and not picture because I want to keep like the broader concept. Okay, thank you.
So thank you, Beate. Just to, not as a summary, but just to have something to grasp on, I want to make 2 points and then we proceed to Antonio. First, I think you have shown how you are interested in, or how an interest in the medieval conceptualization of theory and speculation leads to a kind of a contemporary theoretical problem to think about the temporal structure of pictures and images, a problem that is key, for example, to Gottfried Böhm's ideas about iconic difference, but is also key to very different theorists of images, somebody like Michael Podor in his with his notion of sustained recognition as a kind of temporal process of recognizing what is a picture about, or what is what we can recognize in or thanks to an image. And then you have made the claim that the works of art or images you work on often or always embody conflicting notions of images. And I would to add that for us, it would be highly... for sure, as historians, we are interested in conflicting and contradictory conceptualization of images. But as historians, we also want to have a coherent conception of of images. That is, the conception of images we believe in, or we are submitting, have a certain stance in, and I think this is maybe something we will have to discuss further. But first, we will proceed to Antonio Sommaini, who, as I've already mentioned, has just published a long and insightful article about the concept of medium, article that, among many virtues, helps to defamiliarize this concept. So please, maybe you want to.
Yes. Well, first of all, I would like to thank the Terra Foundation and Ralf Ubler for inviting me to be part in this roundtable. My contribution is exactly related to the idea you so nicely formulated in the text that you suggested to us, whether rethinking pictures could also mean defamiliarize our concepts by reconstructing their emergence, use, and context. As an Italian working in France and collaborating often with German or Anglo-American colleagues, I am constantly involved in issues related to transnational or transcontinental dialogues. And these dialogues very often have to do in about translating concepts from a language to another and reconstructing genealogies that may be very different in different languages. The contribution I'd like to present is related to a very debated concept in image theory, media theory, film theory, which is a concept of medium. I came to it through two different angles. On the one hand, while working on artists or filmmakers like Eisenstein and Moholy Nagy, whose work is constantly located, in the case of Eisenstein, between cinema and the history of the arts, in the case of Moholy Nagy, between film, photography, painting, sculpture. So first of all, I face this question of medium in terms of the old distinction between medium specificity on the one hand and intermediality or transmediality on the other, trying to understand whether the position of these authors could be located on one or the other of these two sides. But what really made me led me to completely defamiliarize the way we think about this concept is the work I did on Benjamin that started 3 years ago, when, together with a colleague that I think you know, Andrea Pinotti from Milan, I was invited by the publishing house, Einaudi, that up to 2010 had owned the exclusive rights for the writings of Benjamin, to rethink how one could present the artwork essay, because they knew that they were going to lose these exclusive rights. They knew that many other translations would have been done, as it happened, and they wanted to kind of come out with a new presentation of this text. And what I suggested to do was to present it within an anthology of texts by Benjamin on media theory, something which, of course, had just been done by Harvard University in a very interesting volume entitled, with the title of The Artwork Essay and Other Writings on Media. So what Andrea Pinotti and I did was to try to see if we could come up with new ways of presenting such a material. And we started with a very careful philological study of really all the occurrences of the term medium in German in Benjamin's writings, something that, of course, was possible thanks to a kind of digital humanity approach, because we could obtain from Zurkamp the entire PDF of all the volumes. So we started listing all the occurrences, constructing kind of constellations of meanings and so on. And what we found was something extremely interesting, which is that Benjamin never ever used the term medium to indicate neither cinema, nor photography, nor radio, nor the telephone. The term used for these technical media was apparat, or taken together as the apparatus of modernity, it would be apparatur, this kind of collective singular. The term medium, instead, is used by him for color, clouds, for aura. Aura is a medium. For the ground in which excavations, archaeological excavations, can be done. It's always used to name kind of extended entities, diffused entities. And most of all, in the what I consider perhaps as the most significant passage in his writings about medium, he uses it in the artwork essay to indicate what he calls the medium der Wahrnehmung, the medium of perception, meaning the environment, the sensible milieu, within which sensory experience takes place. And this environment is, for Benjamin, an environment that is constantly transformed by the technical apparate, a term that does not only indicate photography, cinema, and so on, but basically every kind of technical and material articulation of cultural forms. Very much, I would say, in the sense in which McLuhan uses the term media, in which buildings, roads, clothing can be media because they are material articulation of space. So what we basically came up with was the idea that in Benjamin, media theory is about the study of the historical interplay between, on the one hand, this evolving set of technical and material articulations. And on the other hand, this medium der Wahrnehmung, this medium of perception in which experience takes place. And this somehow kind of defamiliarized not only the understanding I previously had of medium in Benjamin, which still kind of guides the Harvard anthology, but also kind of helped me understand that the history of this concept was actually not at all reducible to this opposition between medium specificity and intermediality. It's actually a history, if we follow it, from Aristotle, from his notion of metaxu, diaphanes, and we move on to, for example, the medieval and modern theories in optics about media diaphana and so on. It's a history in which we find at least four main genealogical traditions. One being the tradition that considers media as technical instruments for recording, transmitting information, and so on. Another one being the tradition we're mostly familiar with in studies in aesthetics, meaning the medium as a series of supports and techniques constituting a form of representation, like painting, sculpture, and so on. There is then the very important and long-lasting occult tradition, the medium as intermediary people or entities enacting some kind of passage between the living and the dead. And finally, there is this fourth extremely interesting tradition of the medium as milieu, as environment, as Umwelt, as atmosphere. And the history of this concept, we can reconstruct it, for example, by rereading extremely interesting texts like Leo Spitzer's essay on milieu and ambiance back in 1942, or more recently books like the one Geschichte des Medienbegriffs by Stefan Hoffmann, which is very useful in this. And it's a long history that basically it's runs from Aristotle's notions of metaxu and diaphanes in the De Anima, all the way to McLuhan's notion of media as environments, and all the way to contemporary approaches to media in environmental, ecological, geological, or even meteorological terms. So it's basically starting from this careful kind of philological study on Walter Benjamin, somehow I ended up defamiliarizing my approach to this concept and somehow kind of realigning a history that precedes and comes after Benjamin, following this notion. And I find that it's extremely useful even today in analyzing a whole series of artistic productions and filmic productions and so on, to think about the medium as actually the production of a space, of an environment for sensory experience. It's also linked to this idea of networks mm-hmm. and operations that you were mentioning. So, I felt very, very kind of in agreement with the way you phrased the invitation to participate in this dialogue. And I am totally convinced that the interest of these transnational or transatlantic dialogues lies also very often in these moments of the familiarization, this kind of ostranienie of concepts that all of a sudden reorganize history in a different way.
So since panels like ours are never able to resolve any problem, I think it's important to now, since we have so much consensus, to create some dissent. And so I want to come back to the concept of operation, because the concept of operation has been also essential for me and my other members of the research project ICONES in Basel, of which I'm director since 2012, when we had to write our new funding grant in 2012. And I thought about this huge project with 50 collaborators from 12 certain disciplines. And I thought, how to make it possible that everybody really likes to work about images, and not only because it's a kind of funding cornucopia. So I thought that the concept of operation is helpful. So we thought about how images enable operations, how they're products of operations, and so that's the way we brought everybody, at least that was my hope, into the boat and really commit themselves to pictures and images, although maybe their disciplinary background is in history of science, musicology, sociology, whatsoever. But at the same time, when I was so immersed in this kind of strategic operation, I also asked myself, okay, this is now very pragmatic, and I think it's also enabling for research to look at the concept of operation. But it is valid for all kinds of artifacts, mm-hmm. all kinds of artifacts. Maybe that's also the reason why it's so enabling. And it does not tell us a lot about what is genuine, what is specific about images and pictures. And the same if I take up Antonio's presentation. If you think about a history of the concept of Bild, let's stay with the German term. One way to go, or maybe the most important way to go, is to see Bild in relationship to form. So Bild in German as Gebilde, bilden, so Bild as another term to emphasize the aspect of formation of also of the artifact in a picture or an image. And on the other hand, you have a completely different notion of or concept of Bild in mathematics. A mathematische Abbildung is something like the relationship between two sets. So it's a mathematical function. And as soon as you try to start thinking systematically about Bild, you realize very quickly that you won't be able to write a theory that covers all those different meanings of the term Bild from, let's say, a kind of modernist idea of the artwork as Gebilde, as form, on the one hand, to a kind of mathematical conception of Abbildung. And in the project Wolfram Pichler and I pursued, in the book we have published, we thought that the best thing is to start with very obvious examples, like something everybody would recognize as a picture, as an image, and where also transculturally it's somehow astonishing that we are able to recognize something as a picture from a culture we don't know anything else about it, but we know this has to be a picture. This is not a table or an ornament, but this is a picture. So to start with these very obvious examples, and when we started with this, when we looked at these obvious examples, it seemed to us necessary to differentiate between three different terms, so that there's something like a support or a vehicle. So, for example, a kind of material support. In art history, we have this concept of the support. Then support allows us to recognize something in it. In this respect, we followed Ernst Gombrich and Flint Shear and others who put the emphasis on the process of recognition. And then as a third dimension, which is not really necessary, but mostly associated to pictures and images, that they are used as signs to substitute or commemorate or whatsoever something else. This differentiation between, let's say, the content of the picture and the referent is a distinction takes quite a lot of pages to spell it out, and also a lot of resistance among readers, but it seems to be a crucial distinction, because what is the referent of a picture will exist whether the picture is destroyed or not, whereas what is the content of the picture will be destroyed if the picture is destroyed. So this is also a kind of a statement one can discuss at length, but I just give it as a kind of first spotlight on what we mean by this distinction between the content and the referent. But in the second part of the book, we focused on something which is maybe more closer to our considerations here, and this is not really materiality, but the kind of form of the picture, the form of the support. So the support of a picture is not just material, not just something passive, but as we art historians, also film scholars all know, it's something formed. And insofar as it is formed, it also forms or structures what allows us to recognize in it. And in this, I think this is really the part of our book where art historians seem to be most, although both of us, both authors are art historians, but this part is the book where art historians feel most at home, because it's about images as artifacts, and about the question how the shape of the support is something that is theoretically relevant and interesting. So from this point of view, I think I don't create a lot of dissents here, but on the other hand, I really would like to emphasize that also as an art historian, it is of great interest to us to distinguish iconic artifacts, so artifacts that are made to be looked as pictures or images, from other artifacts, which are also maybe artworks or objects of our inquiry.
So maybe I'll jump in there and respond to two things. And it, so the question of operation, I completely understand what you mean when you say that it can be, and you clearly used it as a catch-all term, and that it is enabling precisely because of its generality. But I think this notion brings me to maybe a dissent with what you said at the outset about our ultimate goal being something like a general theory of images, because I'm not actually sure I believe in that as our goal, or in the idea of that as the promise of what we do. Because for me, well, and so to step back to say, the idea of operation isn't so much a matter of definition, but for me, operation has to do with what questions I ask. So rather than asking, well, what does this picture or image or artifact or object or table, although rest assured I haven't written about tables, says, I'm curious to know the verb side of things, what it does and what it makes us do. And I think, and this leads me to a response to what you said about the three parts, the support, the thing in the support, and the status of the thing in the support as a kind of sign or as content or as language. Because I would like to propose thinking about a paradigm, now that even though I've discounted the notion of the promise of general theory of images, I would like to propose taking the idea of content and or referent out of the equation as a proposition for thinking about pictures as not necessarily things with which we should concern ourselves as carriers of content chiefly, or as things that have reference in the world chiefly. Because if you take the referent question of the content out of the picture, you're left with a whole other way to describe or imagine a picture, which is as a cluster of operations or as a medium defined as a kind of, recall your words, an extended and diffused entity or space, or in Beata's term, as a kind of double or multiple temporal thrust, right? So I wonder if if we remain perpetually in thrall of the notion of content and or referent as the fundamental units for art history, how much we wind up not being able to say and think about pictures.
I'm happy to answer, but I think maybe what the two of you two.
One thing I would strongly oppose, since we want to have dissents here, is when you say we should, some of your terms really only function with pictures we consider as art or art to be made at, to really have a primarily looking at function. Mm. And that would kind of kill, I would say, 90% of the things I'm working with. And so I wonder what we gain if we kind of exclude a very long durée moment and focus. And then I would be really curious how did we get there, and what has actually changed in the in-between that we suddenly get so much out of it. And I like Bildvehikel, I like thinking about the form of support, and I find it totally absolute inspiring way to look at that. But I think there are derivatives from former positions and constellations that kind of fold into that. Mm-hmm. And if I think about my world of images, I think a lot of what I'm dealing with has changed into something else. And I think the question of the prehistory of some of your categories shouldn't be excluded, and then I can perfectly live with them.
Can I just jump in there and say, in addition to what you just said, which I agree with completely, another way to articulate that is to evoke Baxendall's writing about museums and the museum effect, which posits things in museums as to be looked at. Right? And there are many, many things in museums that weren't made to be looked at. Many things were made to be hidden or buried. In the case of Neolithic carving, those carvings were made on rocks that were then turned inward toward the cliff so that they could never be looked at all. And so I wonder if the condition to be looked at is in fact limiting, especially if we're thinking not only about the traditions of European and American, or at least art of the United States, but broader traditions and manifestations of what we would call picture making that isn't so much a matter of making things to be looked at.
Okay, I think now I have to. Sorry,
go ahead.
Overwhelming.
Go ahead.
I completely feel.
Well, you asked for dissent.
Yeah, sure. No, I'm happy. Generally speaking, I would say that to draw distinction does not mean to exclude anything. I think this is a little bit a red herring, particularly in German Bildwissenschaft, that everything has to be a Bild in order to be included, so that Bild is the new Kunst, mm-hmm. Bild image is the new art, which I think is completely, I think we shouldn't go this, I think to
I
distinguish, to to an artifact to be created, an artifact that is created to be recognized as an image. Maybe it's a better way to put it. I didn't want to emphasize the on looking. But if you speak about artifacts that are not were not created to be looked at the way we look at pictures at Instagram or in the Louvre, but some are hidden and so on. Nevertheless, I think we shouldn't mystify this. I think they were made by people who, in making them, looked at them. So I think you cannot take it out of the equation. There's this kind of desire today to think about images that are not made for human beings,
yes.
That are made for gods and machines. And I really don't know what this means. I think I have deep suspicion against this desire. If the picture was hidden, it was man-made, and somebody looked at it when he or she made it. From my point of view, this is no reason to exclude it. And then the problem, so for sure we can look at a painting, for example, by Winslow Homer, and look at it as a kind of terrain of operations. And if I were, for example, in conservation, that's what I would mostly do. And also as an art historian, this is very productive to look at this as a... But I would assume, at least in the work I know you have written about Winslow Homer, looking at on the operations does not mean only to look at the material operations.
Oh, no, certainly not.
Not at all. It means on a lot of imaginary operations.
Yes.
And then you are deeply immersed in content, I would say. I think there's a modern, although I'm a committed modernist, I'm always surprised about how much implicit modernism is in art history. There's this kind of deep suspicion against content and reference, and I don't know why. To me, it's some kind of modernist, not well understood modernism that is somehow pervasive in art history among a lot of colleagues I deeply admire, but at least I always have this experience, this kind of discussion I had very often. I still have,
do you think then, I am an Americanist and I write about landscape painting and I write about Winslow Homer. Ralph is referring to the introduction to picturing in which I use, Winslow Homer as a case study. But I wonder then if, because I certainly am not not anti-content, but I wonder if what I'm gesturing towards is a reimagining or a more expansive view of what content might mean and how we define it. And so maybe it's meaning that is more troublesome to me than content, but we'd like to hear from you.
I'm not sure that I can connect to this line of thought that has been developing. I was actually thinking about how certain talking again about translations from a language to the other, how, for example, this question of that we've been using two words, picture and image, that have given rise to many discussions about their distinction. Distinction that we don't have in German, that we don't have in Italian, that we don't have, that instead English. And going back to my own issue and my own studies with medium, I was, for example, working in France. I was faced with the fact that here, for what is in other languages just one term, medium and media in the plural, there are actually two different terms, medium, media, which open up and are used in two rather different and kind of polemically related fields. On the one hand, theory of mass media and mass media communication and so on, the media, and on the other one, the field of aesthetics and art theory that instead uses medium. So it's interesting because whereas in English, the fact that we have two terms for one kind of opens up for very interesting potential hermeneutic possibilities. In France, the presence of these two terms actually blocks things because it creates a kind of artificial division that you don't have in the German median or the English media, in which allows you to play with the different meanings of medium without weaving them out completely. It's another way of talking about these translations problems. And
I think we have about 10 minutes, and maybe there are urgent, there's a strong urge among in the audience to add something to our discussion.
On Ernst, you did have that, but it's this notion of interpretation as something that's always in motion, and I now seem to also see emerge something as a notion of the picture as something always in motion. So there is a sense of fluidity that's back, of relationality, which I think is there in this interest in material studies, the fact that you don't fixate or you don't stop meaning, you don't describe, you don't put it in language. It's an ongoing thing between the onlooker and then whatever is being or felt or seen. But I just wanted to put that a bit more on the table, because it is a very different way of I think thinking about images, as no longer seeing them as crispy with the word that I would use in French.
What is also interesting is to try to understand why all of a sudden, since some time, we are all talking about materiality, because this is perhaps the fourth occasion within the last few weeks in which I'm involved in discussions about ideas of material approach to media, material approach to aesthetics, material approach to images. Why is there this drive to rematerialize things? And I don't know, I have some reflections about it, but it would be interesting to also maybe hear from the audience. I think that, for example, in my field, in film and media studies, the passage from the analog to the digital has produced a whole discourse and even a whole ideology of dematerialization that very often just hides the incapacity of understanding the new materials, because the digital is never dematerialized. The glass screen of my computer is not a dematerialized image at all. So in my field, this question of materiality is actually led by a drive to counter this ideology of dematerialization and by a need to better understand the new matters, the new materials that produce and circulate images and so on. It would be interesting to know why in art history this term is taking place.
We actually had that earlier because we tried to go against iconographic interpretation and iconology, that everything always has one meaning, and we tried to find ways to get out of that problem and to look at visual context and performative aspects and whatever, and material and materiality was kind of a promise we had, and a lot of studies have then been done in the hope to kind of find a somewhat neutral ground that connects images, ideas that are brought to them, the artistic work, artistic practice, and actually image production in a perhaps more concrete realm, but at the same time also figure out where are origins of meaning and where do they kind of, when do they get ascribed to which material at what point, and how well was that understood and how long this understanding lasted. So there was a long materiality discussions in the medieval and early modern field, and so kind of for us it's like, oh, materiality, okay.
Again. Yeah. No, whereas, whereas in film and media studies there was a lot this idea of a kind of an evaporation of the materiality of the analog image and so on.
But the interesting thing is the promise that we had that we get away with that there is one meaning, and you seem to have somewhat...
Not at all. No.
Well, an interesting either analogous or opposite idea about it, that it gets you a handle on what happens at this transition to digitalization, what is actually remaining in this process, and perhaps that's an interesting one.
Yeah, I'll just say, I mean, the version of what both of you just described in my field of the history of American art and visual culture manifested as a certain kind of and a very dominant approach to interpretation, which I uncharitably call political formalism, but others call social art history. And this is not to disparage that work, but there was a long period in writing about American art history in which people simply didn't talk, and this is going to sound ridiculous, about paint or mark making or facture. And I think that what I want my work to do isn't so much return attention only to paint, right? Because I'm not, in evoking materiality, I'm not evoking matter, brute matter. This is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking, and so, the social art history was interested in the material in terms of a kind of Marxist materialism or historical materialism. But I think, for me, materiality is looking at the multiple conditions that gave rise to a picture or an object or an image or whatever we want to call it. And those include, and this would align with what Beata said about the sources of meaning, right? Those conditions include brute matter. They include social relationships and conditions produced by, say, high capitalism, for instance. But they also refer to the... Now I don't want to use the word operations because I'm going to get in trouble. But they refer to, you know, conditions ranging from the studio to the other kinds of apparatuses, note-taking, diary-keeping that artists engage in. And so materiality for me is maybe it's conditionality and the intersubjective or... the intersubjectivities and interrelationalities produced within those conditions that give rise to the thing, right? So that would be, in a sense, my way of describing why I have turned in the direction I have in my work, because political formalism was a certain kind of dematerialization.
Absolutely.
Analogous to what you're describing vis-a-vis media and film.
There's also in French aesthetics, still now in film studies, a very strong kind of formalist, dematerialized approach to images that talks about forms and plasticity in just phenomenological terms, in terms of the way they appear, not investigating the actual. But isn't this turn to materiality also a kind of renouncing to the very idea of brute matter? Mm-hmm. It seems to be led for me by an idea that in every kind of material or matters, there's always some kind of agency, mediated dimension, some kind of active, operational. So this idea of brute matter all of a sudden is kind of evacuated by an approach to materiality as always active and somehow.
Yeah, well, I guess I would say that even brute matter is itself an agent or active in its obdurateness, right?
Absolutely.
And so when I write about paint, I don't simply write about pigment, tempera versus oil. I talk about what paint can and can't do and what we can make it do and what we can't make it do. So yes, absolutely.
So next to materiality, temporality is one of the limit conditions of our finitude and also the finitude of our panel. I think we are at the end of the
Vanitas, we finish on memento mori note.
Antonio, thanks a lot for bringing the discussion back to the notion of materiality and that it certainly must not be reduced to some kind of mere passive matter. I think this was a very important point, and thanks to all of you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.